Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Just a little All right. bit longer.
Awesome. Hello. Hello, internet.
We're in you.
Hello.
Why is that the thing that gets you? Like, of all the things that have ever been said, like, why is
because
that?
Because this is a curated, family-friendly forum.
We do have the expletive
we
designation.
Do. That wasn't my choice. That was your choice, so you wouldn't have to censor.
Yeah.
But it's okay. Hello, segmented portion of the internet.
Hello, seedy corners of the interwebs.
Yeah. Okay.
The dark web, hello.
Welcome back to the Garage Hockey Podcast. We've been out of the studio for God knows how long, but it doesn't really matter. Stanley Cup Finals are in full swing. What is the score? Penguins?
Two.
Two. Predators, one.
Yep. Yeah.
I don't know how to feel about this series.
Why?
Well, partly because before the series started, the Predators were going to be without Ryan Johansson, and I thought that was really going to be a crutch.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, you know, the Penguins, it took them 7 games to beat Washington. It took them 7 games to beat Ottawa. So,
and they're still injury decimated.
And, you know, although the Penguins won the first 2 games and kind of, I mean, I don't want to say they looked dominant, but they ran up the score here and there. I thought that
they absolutely did not look dominant. They had, what, 12 shots?
Well, but it, that's the thing is they, it felt like they were, or it didn't feel like they were dominating, but then every time you looked up, they would be scoring.
Yeah, yeah.
So it didn't really make any sense. And then, meanwhile, the Predators were just, you know, especially in game one, they were driving play. They were doing everything right. I think game two, a bit of a drop-off. And then game three, well, the Predators finally, you know, made good.
They finally got the fruit of their labor.
What it felt like in game three was, it was one of those games where they couldn't miss. The Predators, every shot they took.
Game three?
Yes, the game they won.
Yeah.
Like, obviously that wasn't the case because, you know, Pittsburgh goalie still had saves. But, you know, like, whenever they had a good look, it seemed like, you know, they were scoring. Even when they didn't have good looks, you know, they were still getting the bounces.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really feel like, oh, Nashville's finally, you know, showed up to the series. It felt like they had one of those games where everything was bouncing their way. And I'm very curious to see the next game. Obviously, Pittsburgh's going to come out stronger. You know, every losing team in the cup final comes out better in the next game. But, you know, does Nashville, you know, do they take a step back in the way they look? Or, you know, is it just going to be Pittsburgh playing harder? And whether or not Nashville wins the second game or, you know, if they lose, is it going to be because of Pittsburgh or because of Nashville?
Well, yeah, I think that's an interesting question. And that's why before the series started, I was so conflicted because part of it, obviously both teams have their drawbacks, but both of their strengths kind of offset each other's. Like the Predators have this really good blue line and, you know, just an overall solid team game. And the Penguins had a decimated blue line, but this forward group that just can't seem to stop scoring.
Yeah.
And then Matt Murray, who's playing really well. Meanwhile, it seemed like Pekka in the Nashville net was, I mean, he has cooled off significantly, but it already felt that way going into the series. So going into game four, I feel like this Penguins team can be beat in a series. I don't think that, you know, although they looked so good in the first 2 games, if Nashville can just keep doing this and they can just get some saves, because that's also been a pretty big issue. I mean, I could see them winning the series, but then again, I could also see them not being able to score, Pekka Rinne not being able to make any saves, and Pittsburgh kind of running away with it. But you felt a little frustration in Pittsburgh's game.
Oh yeah,
in game three, that you didn't really feel, kind of in the whole playoffs. It seemed like they felt a little human for the first time. And
you definitely tell by the way Malkin and Kessel were acting in the third period.
Yeah, I think that was the only other time that you really felt it was when Kessel had that meltdown on the bench against Ottawa.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, the way they play, if it starts to unravel, I think it's going to unravel very quickly because their blue line, I know Justin Schultz is back, but it's, they all look pretty bad.
Ole Mata has been walked around in the series. Trevor Daly has not looked quite like himself.
And Ron Hainsey looks glacial out there.
Yeah. Not surprising.
Yeah, really, but with Mata, I almost think he either might be hurt or something.
He didn't look good in the Ottawa series either. He actually looked awful.
He just looks very slow, and he looks like there was the goal by Forsberg. Was it game two?
Where
he got walked around.
Around. Yeah.
It almost seemed like he was either reluctant to go into contact or he just couldn't push.
Like he couldn't pivot in
time. I don't know if he can't be that bad. I mean, he might be, but you know, it seemed like something was wrong there more than just, because think about it. So Forsberg is a right-handed shot and he's coming down the left wing and he had time to just push the puck on Mata's left side and skate all the way around him back to the puck.
Yeah.
Get it, go around Matt Murray and score.
Yeah.
Like, as a defenseman, all you got to do there is, like, you know, poke check or something.
Mm.
And it just seemed like he was unable to do anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, Forsberg was coming at such an extreme angle. So, I don't know.
Because it looked like he was going to have him for a second, and then it was like, oh, nope, he doesn't have him.
I mean, sometimes you just got to give credit to the guy who made the play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think part of, you know, being a good defenseman is never really being surprised by anything.
Mm.
And it seemed like Mata was like, oh, wait, like regular forwards don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't usually find myself in this situation. So I don't know. And part of it, you know, I think when you're a defenseman who struggles in open ice, speaking from heavy experience, you just get to the point where you get so reluctant to make any play that you just stop really committing because either you don't trust your ability to get back, your ability to be aggressive and recover. And maybe that was part of it there on that play. I mean, we're probably reading a little too much into that one play. But when I compare to a guy like Hampus Lundholm, which isn't maybe the fairest of comparisons because he's probably one of the like six best defensemen in the league, but he's always able to extend himself in a one-on-one situation, but also stay, you know, sort of like in that knees bent position. He's never overextending himself.
Mm.
And, you know, like what I've noticed with a really good defenseman is instead of being like, cause you know, back in the day, it was all about like being the Scott Stevens or the Chris Pronger where you could just level a guy. But now guys seem to have mastered the kind of like the heavy push.
Where
you're just kind of up on a guy and you're just making sure he feels you and you can come in and just kind of move him without overcommitting. And also you have the foot speed to get back. So that's a long winded way of saying Ole Mata might just not be that good. I don't know.
I was impressed with him when he first broke into the NHL and then unfortunately he had a bunch of injuries.
And he also was playing with Letang, I think, which you know, might have helped.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But you know, recently, like the past year or two, I have not been very impressed by him. Like he looks sort of like a fourth defenseman, someone that you don't really want to rely on, something you pair him with someone better.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you know, playing with Letang when he first broke in, you know, that might be the situation with him. He was just paired with someone better, and that's why he looked really good.
Yeah. Well, defensemen are so tricky to evaluate because on one hand, you know, it's easy to say, oh, well, he only looked good because of this. But if you have a good synergy between two guys and it works, like that's worth something, you know, like complementary skills when you're, you know, formulating a lineup are so important that I think, you know, I think sometimes we say, oh yeah, he was playing with Letang, so everything he did was invalid, you know, like, no, like if you're able to hang with a good player and contribute, that's worth something. The issue is, I think that the bigger issue is that it skews perception long term.
Mm.
And then people start thinking, oh yeah, that guy's really good. Oh wait, like no, he probably isn't.
Yeah.
And that's I think what's happened a bit with like Roman Josi in Nashville.
All the Roman Josi truthers are out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, he got to play with prime Shea Weber.
Yeah.
Who was actually very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And still is in the offensive zone.
Yeah. But anyway, looking at the rest of the series, going forward, do you think who takes it ultimately?
Pittsburgh.
Well, where do you feel like the wind is blowing?
Like, I honestly think it's going to go the same, like the in terms of games won by Pittsburgh and whoever they're playing against, whether San Jose or Nashville, it's going to go the same pattern. Pittsburgh won first two, then the other team wins one, then Pittsburgh wins game four, mm-hmm. then the other team, then they take in six.
Really?
Yeah. No, I feel the same way. It just kind of has the same kind of feeling as it did last year.
I don't get this.
I don't get this. It all hinges on...
It feels a little blind.
Maybe.
Blind faith.
What are you trying to say?
Well, the thing is, I don't think that Pittsburgh can't win. I watch these two teams play, and I don't think there's very much, if at all, separating them. And if anything, Nashville is playing better. But Pittsburgh just has this way of overcoming getting outshot. That might be the thing
with me. The way Nashville played in the first game. I think it wavered my confidence in them.
Yeah.
They looked great during the game, but especially like Pecorine, there's just a lot that came at them that should have been stopped that wasn't.
Yeah, I think the goaltending is such a backbreaker because, you're spending all this time in the other team's zone. You're forcing dump-ins into your own zone. You're controlling the neutral zone. And then the other team comes down, wrist shot from the wing, beats your goalie short side. It's just, it's a backbreaker.
Yeah, or like that Malkin goal on, I think it was on the power play that, I can't remember if it was game one or game two, but Rene just whiffed on it with the glove.
I think it's game one.
Yeah, and it's just like, these are stoppable shots. And
that was game two.
It's backbreaking mm-hmm. when that happens. So I think Rene is better than that, and he came back and played very well yesterday. But, you just kind of don't know what you're going to get.
Well, so that's interesting. So for game three, obviously, Pecorine looked awful in game two. And then the big question was, well, who is Laviolette going to go to in game three? And he was super secretive about it. And like almost annoyingly so.
It was never going to be a question because a lot of people in sports journalists and the talking heads and whatnot were saying they were bringing up
the crooked media.
Yeah, yeah. They're bringing up say Chicago for example. How you have Corey Crawford, but if he doesn't look bad, you have Scott Darling. Well, yeah, but Scott Darling is a starting goalie on most teams
for the Carolina Hurricanes.
Yeah, right. and Saros is not a starting goalie.
Yeah, it's a different situation.
So that's interesting. But wait, you had to finish your point.
So like the speculation around maybe you sit Rene for a game. Yeah, well no, because Saros isn't going to win you a game. He might not lose you the game, but he's not going to win you the game. And against Pittsburgh, you might need your goalie to win you the game, at least bail you out.
Yeah,
and Saros is not going to do that. And then suddenly you're down 3-0.
Yeah.
Like you can't sit Pecorine with a prospect of facing down 3-0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Rene was so good in the first three rounds. I'm not just going to bail on him after two games.
You definitely have to have a talk with him. It was like, dude, you need to be better. Yeah. And, figure out whatever is, whatever he's off on. But, Pecorine was always going to start game three. And, I don't know, Laviolette, just trying to, not give the media anything. I'm sure that's all it was.
Because you're just trying to hurt the other team's ability to game plan.
Yeah.
But on the subject of Rene, so what I found interesting is that you had two sides of the debate. One was the more traditional Coach Laviolette. Oh, he's the guy who got us here. We have to go to him. And then you had predictably, the analytics crowd being, well, UC Saros. No, I don't.
That was such a dead-on impression.
No, sometimes it feels that way. I'm sorry.
Wasn't that the beginning of The Matrix? It's like you have a blue pill and a red pill. Like you have the blue pill, but there's also a red pill.
So
do whatever you want.
So, look, I love hockey stats just like the next guy, and I use them quite a bit in my articles and stuff, but sometimes I feel like the analytics-minded folk, sometimes they really overlook the human element.
Mm-hmm.
But what I mean by that is, so you have this guy, UC Saros, who's a rookie, who has not played the entire playoffs, played maybe 20 games in the regular season, and all of a sudden to ask him to start in a game in a must-win game three, just because he had a better save percentage in 20 games, you know, in games in November and January or whatever, I don't know if that guarantees you anything in game three.
Yeah,
you know, and Pecorino is a proud guy, and
really professional athletes are proud of being the best. Okay,
and you know, I just think I can't blame a coach for, you know, heat of the moment, not even heat of the moment, but just you're in a series and you're the one that's feeling the consequences of each decision you make. I can't blame a guy for just sticking with what's generally worked.
Yeah.
You know, so I get why people were up in arms about them going back to him, but at the same time, you kind of have to somewhat understand it. Now, there's that angle, obviously, but there's also just like, what's the right move? What's the wrong move there? For me, I would have seriously thought about Saros just because Pekka looks so bad.
Well, yeah.
It wasn't even, and the thing is, you can't wait for him to turn it around because by the time he might, the series might be over.
And that's the thing, as a coach, it is absolutely your responsibility to consider all your options. You, even if your gut instinct is telling you, no, we're going to stick with Pekka, you're doing your team a disservice by not at least thinking about it.
Right.
And you can, you know, it's like, my gut's telling me no, I'm going to think about it. Okay, I thought about it. I'm still going to go with my gut. You absolutely do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, just because you think about it doesn't mean you're going to, you know, paralysis by analysis.
Right.
You know, so, right. Like, absolutely, you know, Pecorino looked awful. You have to consider Saros. Once you consider Saros, you're going to realize we have to stick with Rene.
Yeah, it's a tough call. And, you know, what's interesting with Rene is that some people were, again, some people from a certain side of the aisle were like, you know, the goal he gave up to, I think it was Shiri in game two, where he was hugging his post and Shiri just kind of threw it on net backhanded and it just kind of slipped between his glove and his body. And someone was like, and you know, it was the smallest of openings and the puck,
you couldn't see the opening.
The puck had to be on its side to go in. And someone was like, this is what puck luck looks like. And I'm like, if you're the goaltender in that situation, stop it. Stop the puck. Like, you know, you have everything covered. Like, find a way. And what I found ironic there is that Pekka's glove was, like, frozen. And everyone loves to talk about his active glove and how, you know, he'll field ground balls. And he's just, like, this wizard with the active glove hand. But then in that situation, his glove hand's just sitting there. So, and, you know, it predictably last game also, just on a side note, Matt Murray lets in, I think, three goals on the glove side?
Four.
On the glove side.
Yeah. Four.
And obviously,
Fleury.
After the game, you know, is there something wrong with Matt Murray's glove side?
Yeah.
I mean, I think, what, two breakaways?
Yeah.
One breakaway... At least one breakaway, one deflected shot. I mean,
and two of them, I think, were through screens. Or...
Yeah,
I do have to say, if I remember correctly,
the Gaudreau goal was really nice.
I think that when the Sharks started scoring goals in Game Three, they're keying glove side on Murray. Also,
they were going over his shoulder in general. The weird thing, when I went back and watched the goals that Murray allowed yesterday, the ones that went glove side, it looked like he was whiffing on them. It looked like he was reaching out, trying to attack with his glove, and just missing.
Especially the Gaudreau goal.
Yeah, he absolutely whiffed on it.
Yeah. So,
but it looked that way on all of them, and they weren't all his fault. There were some bad defensive breakdowns, but it did not look that good.
Yeah, but to circle back to the whole Rene versus Saros debate, obviously it's not that easy, and I just wish people would kind of acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
But like we were discussing earlier, at the same time, what is the right move in that situation? And with goalies, it's tough to say what is the right move because goalies are so unpredictable.
That's the thing.
What would you have done if you were in that position?
I would have stuck with Rene just because he had played so well in the prior three rounds. And it's not the same thing as going from Fleury to Murray, where Murray played a lot of games this year he got it done last year.
Yeah, Murray's a known quantity.
Yeah, you have Pecorino, and you have UC Saros, who hasn't done anything and hasn't played in a while.
Well, he's been really good in the minors and before that. So
yeah, but it's still
he has some pedigree.
It's still different. I would stick with Rene, and like you said, it's unpredictable. You have no idea. Maybe he turns in the best game of his life the next game, or maybe he keeps playing the same way. You have no way of knowing. So I'm just going to go with the guy that I think, one, is actually better and that I trust more.
Yeah.
My dude, let's not act like UC Soros is something right now. Like, in a game of something or nothing, UC Soros is nothing. And I'm not saying that he's going to be nothing forever, but right now he's kind of nothing.
Oh, my.
That's, yo.
So we have the first...
that's a hot take.
The first mic slam
yeah.
In GHP history.
Let's not forget, the last time that you grabbed the mic was when you said that St. Louis was boring.
Yes.
And then you came out the next game and St. Louis was not boring.
But you just damn near broke the thing.
Yeah.
And to lend some credence to your point, although I'm not sure the internet is ever a good gauge of anything, but if you Google UC Soros, the first link that comes up is, who is UC Soros? TSN.
Oh, that's what TSN?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I've been validated by the mainstream media.
It's not even like the Nashville paper or something. Like, it's from TSN, a hockey outlet.
That's excellent. So I feel good about that take.
It was pretty spicy. I don't like the direction we're trending in with these spicy takes. First, there was Joe saying that the Oilers shouldn't be a franchise. wasn't that a thing?
I didn't use those exact words, but yes.
And then now UC Soros is in a game of something or nothing.
He's
UC
nothing.
Soros is nothing.
He's nothing. Dust.
Well, so yeah, 21 games this season in Nashville. He had a .923.
That's good.
Let's go back to his days in the Finnish league. So his first season for HPK Hämeenlinna, he had a .928.
Good.
The season after, he had a .929. His first season in the AHL, so his first season in North America, he had a .920. And then his second season, he only played 15 games this year in the AHL, but a .934.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's a pretty strong indication that he's going to be a good goalie.
I think the strong...
He's listed as 5'11", but when I saw him skate out in game two, I thought he was like 5'10".
He did not look that big.
Yeah, he didn't. But he seems pretty good.
It seems like he could be something. I'm just saying right now.
But if we're playing this arbitrary game right now.
Yeah, just right now, I'm going with the known quantity.
Yeah, for me...
The known good quantity.
Known good, well...
It's known well.
Let's not act like he's never been good in his career.
Pekka?
Yeah.
Well, no, but he just looks so bad.
No, I know.
And my issue with him isn't just that he looked bad. It's that the goals he lets in are just so deflated. And it was the same thing against Nashville.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. It was the same thing against Anaheim. Some of those shots by Richie and Silverberg just blindly throwing it on net from the wing. And he's like...
Yeah. And
he's like confused.
He looks surprised by it.
Like, he's trying to catch it on his blocker side, you know, stuff like that. And
I never, like, it's never a good sign when the goalie reaches across his body to catch
it.
Well,
it wasn't all the way across, but it was like he's so obsessed with the whole, like, active glove hand hype that I think it gets in his own way. For me, I don't know definitively what I would have done, but I think I would have leaned towards Soros. Just because I think with goalies, you have to... If it's not working, there's no way to know when it will work again.
Yeah.
So you can't wait to switch, you know?
Yeah.
You have to just do it and see. Because otherwise, it's kind of like hitting in baseball, where you just never know when it's going to turn around. So and if you don't inject some juice into the lineup, no pun intended. But shout out to the Yankees of the mid-2000s. But unless you add some pop...
Yeah.
Not some cork.
shout out to Sammy Sosa.
Unless you don't do anything, it's tough to just say, yeah, it'll turn around. You know, it's like, I feel like the Giants have had a few seasons like that where it's like, oh, we're hitting poorly. And then it just, oh, like our season ended up pretty bad, you know? So I don't know.
I
feel like hitting in baseball and goaltending in hockey are actually kind of similar in a sense because they're both... Well, I guess some people think they have hitting figured out, but I think in general, they're very hard to predict.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah, it is hard to predict.
And go ahead.
Another sort of comparable, it's not exact, But I'm going to pose a question to you because, you know, you're the goalie. at least you have been
was,
the goalie.
Was.
So we saw Ben Bishop get injured in the finals. And, you know, they still went with Bishop over, I believe, Vasilevsky was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was the backup. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing in the NHL in the playoffs mm-hmm. is, you know, if an injured player, like if it's a superstar or, yeah. you know, just someone like a top six,
mm-hmm.
if they can go, if they can move their legs,
yeah.
are they better than, you know, the person replacing them? And a lot of times the answer is no.
Okay. Well, I think I know what you're getting at. I think from experience, so like this happened to me when my team at UC Irvine, we went to Nationals my rookie season, and I was the backup. And I didn't touch the ice once, except for warmups. But there was one instance where our starter he got ran into. A guy was driving to the net, and he was down for a little bit. And then my coach started looking at me, and I was like, "Fuck!" Like, but at the same time, you know, you're a competitor. So, and I've had other instances where the goalie gets pulled, and you know, you go in, or goalie gets hurt, you go in and you go out there and you're like, let's do this. You know, you're ready to prove yourself. The issue with that is that you come in and you feel like, all right, like this is my time to shine, but you might almost be a little overeager. Mm. You know, like you might challenge a little too much, or your pushes might be too aggressive. At least that's what I kind of had in my own experience. But I do think though that regardless, when a guy comes in, to even make it to the NHL as a goalie, you have to have that competitive streak. You have to deep down think you're better than the starter. Yeah. You know, unless you're I don't know, like Peter Budaj and Carey Price. But outside of that, you know, I think that you have to have that mentality that I can come in and stop everything and win this whole thing for the team, you know.
So do you think you know, Pecorier is not injured, he's just not playing as well as he could be playing.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a similar situation where Rene, who is not playing up to par,
mm-hmm.
would it still be better than the backup goalie?
Well, that's kind of the issue, because so these guys are still, so the backup is still working out every day. He's in the gym. He's staying after practice, but nothing can simulate, you know, 5-on-5, you know, having to account for a backdoor pass or tip-ins or guys running into you. You know, uncalled penalties, like there's no way to really simulate that. You know, that's kind of the beauty of baseball sometimes, is you can just send a guy down and he can just, you know, simulate like mm-hmm. pitches. If you're a backup goalie, you know, there's no minors to go down to really, because they need you on the bench. So you can't really get your reps that way. So I think a guy who's getting his reps, maybe he's a little bit better, but if he's struggling, he might already be in his own head. Whereas the backup, he's hungry, he wants to go in, he wants to prove himself, and he's probably a little fresher. Probably a little adjustment period, but I think for a guy like Saros, who I know has been good in his career, I'd feel pretty confident, you know, putting him in. Plus, it sounds like him and Rene have a really good rapport,
mm-hmm.
so it wouldn't be like, oh, you know, Pekka got benched. You know, like I don't think anyone would scoff, or I don't think there'd be any politics yeah. around it.
There's no Joe Montana.
Because goaltending is so political, you know.
It would have been, or it was such a difficult position for Peter Laviolette to be in, because obviously Rene came back and played well, so it's a moot point. And if Saros, if he decided to go with him and he played well, then, you know, no one questions it. But if either Rene played bad in game three, or if he went with Saros mm-hmm. and Saros played bad, everyone would have been like, why didn't you go with the other guy, or why didn't you yeah. keep going with
and,
Rene?
And that's why I think, as a coach who's just concerned about the short, you know, kind of just extremely in the moment, you'd rather get criticized for putting your guy back in than rolling the dice and being like, oh, how could you? Because then if the backup plays bad, then this whole carousel starts back over for game four.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And this is very simplistic, but I think it does bear mentioning, because of how, when a coach or, you know, someone makes a bad decision in terms of management, everyone jumps down their throat right away.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, sports media yeah. you know, across the board.
It is, yeah.
Pierre Laviolette, he knows his team. He's been with them for years now.
Yeah.
He's in the locker room. He knows what they're doing and what they can do. So, like, the three best guys to judge who should be starting that game, one, obviously, it's Laviolette's decision, but also how Rene feels and how Saros feels.
And the goalie
coach.
And the goaltending coach, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know who their goalie coach is anymore in Nashville, because Mitch Korn was there for a long time.
It's probably Brodeur. He's all over the place.
We'll get our in-house statisticians.
Ooh, that actually kind of ties into something I want to talk about.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
But I want to finish up on the Stanley Cup final. Mm. So I think we've kind of talked about everything.
Yeah.
I'll throw you a little something here to end, and then we'll talk about one more thing. Who's the guy who stood out to you the most in the series?
Jake Guentzel has played really, really well.
Yeah, he has.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Look at all the goals. I mean, there's kind of not a whole lot else to say. Mm-hmm. It's just, look at all the goals.
You're constantly hearing his name.
Yeah.
Like, last year it was a combination of, in the finals, hearing Sheary, Guentzel, Rust. Mm-hmm. Guentzel did play.
No.
He didn't?
No, he wasn't in it last year.
Kessel played very well last year. Nick Bonino played very well.
I thought Guentzel just didn't qualify as a rookie from last year.
Mm-hmm. No, that was Matt Murray.
Oh, that was Murray? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Sheary and Rust.
The point stands.
Yeah, so you're constantly hearing Sheary and Rust, and they're alternating, and obviously having two guys going really well, especially two young guys. Anyone will take that.
Mm-hmm.
But like this, not just the series, but the whole playoffs, you're constantly hearing Guentzel's name.
Yeah, well, because he's scoring.
Yeah.
he stood out to me in a different way for the first time in the outdoor game that Pittsburgh played earlier this season.
Oh, so you're a Jake Guentzel, you were in on Jake Guentzel.
Yeah, I'm kind of a Jake Guentzel hipster, you guys.
Are you the Pierre Maguire?
Yeah, I don't think you know.
Are you Pierre-ing right
now? I'm sad to admit that I might be Pierre-ing low-key now.
But you were saying.
He stood out to me for the first time in the outdoor game. And it was for his passing ability. I thought he was a really clever passer.
Oh, so sorry, go ahead, finish.
You know what? I feel like you're ready to throw some shade. So throw your shade.
Not only were you in on Jake Guentzel before everyone, but you were also in on him for a skill that no one is talking about right now.
Yes.
So you're like doubling down on the hipstering.
Yeah.
I like that.
My mustache is thick. My glasses are large.
Thick?
My flannel.
I'm going to stop you right there.
Yeah.
This is going to go badly.
But anyway, I was impressed with his passing ability, and I thought he played really well with Sidney Crosby, which is not easy to do, actually, because of the way he thinks of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's doing it from a goal-scoring perspective, and I don't know. He's been super consistent for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, he's stood out to me more than pretty much anyone.
So you said Guentzel too?
Yeah.
I think for me, it's a toss up between, I think Crosby's looked really good.
He has.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's kind of been their best player, because Malkin hasn't looked, I think he scored in game two. He had a slap shot.
Yeah. On the power play.
But he hasn't looked, I don't know. He hasn't looked quite as dominant as I would have hoped, just given the forwards that they're throwing at him. But he's still trying to drive through the neutral zone. Like he goes 1-on-5, I think, more than anyone in the league.
Yeah, and I love when he does it.
And I mean, like he could pull it off.
Yeah,
but he seems very frustrated.
He and Phil Kessel are both very frustrated.
But I think Sid has really stood out to me.
Yeah,
and then Connor Sheary's looks pretty good too.
Yeah.
He's fast.
Yeah. Oh,
he's really fast.
Yeah. I kind of didn't realize it until recently.
Yeah, but he's smart too. He just kind of knows where to be. I don't think he's that skilled.
That backdoor goal that he scored where Crosby got it to Kunitz and then Sheary was all by himself. Like you have to read the play well to disappear and reappear like that.
And he almost whiffed on it.
He kind of reminds me a bit of Andrew Cogliano, but like a little more skilled.
Yeah.
Because Cogliano is, what he has going for him is his speed and his smarts. And I think that's kind of what Sheary has.
Yeah.
And then for Nashville, I think Subban's looked really good.
I agree.
Him and Ekholm do everything for that team.
Yeah, I've been very impressed with both of them.
Yeah, I think Ellis and Yossi.
Ellis has definitely looked a little subpar.
They haven't really, they just haven't, just watching them purely, I'm not speaking to any stats, they haven't really blown me away. But yeah, Subban and Ekholm. I think Ekholm had like a breakaway last game, or like a semi-breakaway.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so impressive that for as good as Subban and Ekholm are offensively, that they're being deployed as like the shutdown pair, and they're doing just as good of a job of that.
Have you enjoyed this final?
I'm enjoying it. Yeah,
That's tepid.
I'm going to enjoy it a lot more if it gets tied up 2-2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want it to be a runaway.
After game two, I was like, oh man, this is not going to be interesting.
After games one and two, I felt a little sad.
Yeah.
Because I was like, no, I was like, this can't be. I feel like we got the, but I honestly feel like outside of Washington, I feel like we got the two, we got the best possible matchup, I think.
Yeah.
I think we got the two best teams from each conference. I really believe that. Because no one out of the Atlantic was going to be good. Maybe if Boston had been healthy, they would have had a chance.
Yeah.
And if Montreal could have just figured it out, but that's asking a lot.
I mean, game one was exciting because Pittsburgh got off to that running start, and then Nashville came all the way back, and then the go-ahead goal wasn't scored until like 3 minutes left, so it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, but you know, I was just watching, I was like, man, it can't end this way. You know, it would just be so lame if it ended in like five games. So I was a little disappointed, but then Nashville going back to Bridgestone Arena, that crowd, just pure insanity. Yeah. But I love it. It's the catfish, like everything about that.
And the drama's been fun too, like the goalie drama and like PK Subban and Sidney Crosby.
Yeah, like they've just the fact that they crushed them, I feel like it's going to give the series a bit more kick because it felt like Pittsburgh, it didn't seem like they felt challenged. I don't know. Because, you know, when you're playing kind of not that great, but you're scoring on every chance, you probably don't come away from it thinking like, oh yeah, that was tough.
Yeah.
You know, but so the Subban and Crosby thing, this story has spun way out of control.
I can't believe it.
Calling it a story is generous.
So here's what happened. So Subban gets interviewed by Pierre Maguire after the game, and of course Pierre asks him, and I think I would have asked him too, like, so.
And Subban, Pierre interviews him. He seems to like it. You know, he seems to have a good rapport with Pierre.
Yeah, yeah. And so he asked him because at the end of the game there was a bit of a kerfuffle between both teams, and then Subban gets in Sid's ear and they jaw back and forth. And then, so Pierre asked him what was said, and clearly, like, tongue-in-cheek. Like, I don't think there was a sliver of doubt this was tongue-in-cheek. He's like, yeah, oh, yeah, he told me my breath smelled bad, and I told him, well, you know, I put it Listerine every day. Like, I thought I was doing well, but I guess not. Like, I'm paraphrasing. But he was clearly joking. Like, I don't think he meant that. Like, am I crazy here? Like,
no, okay. It's the same thing as, because we all know that players like to keep that stuff on the ice between themselves.
Yeah.
And guys,
he was never going to say what was actually said.
Yeah. And guys make the cheesy joke all the time. Hey, what was said between you and this guy? Oh, we were making dinner reservations, or he invited me over for Thanksgiving dinner. And everyone knows that it's just a joke. Like, it's a sarcastic, cliche joke.
It's sort of like in baseball, whenever you see a pitcher or a batter, or you know, the manager yelling at the umpire, and they clearly say "F you," like everyone knows it. And then the announcer goes, "Oh well, yeah, the manager is telling him how much he disagrees with the call right now."
Yeah, yeah, and they're going to talk about it more over dinner or whatever.
Yeah, like, yeah.
So, we all know it's a joke, and I can't believe that people are actually seriously like analyzing this and breaking it down and like calling in psychologists and like interpersonal communication experts to like dissect this whole thing. Like,
someone's probably hit up Listerine about this.
This is fake news.
Well, and then so PK was asked about it again. I think clearly, once again, tongue in cheek, he was like, oh yeah, that's what I said. Like,
he's doubling
down. And then they asked Sid about it, and Sid, I don't think he gave it much thought, but he was like, well, that's not what was said, and if he wants to say that stuff, then that's up to him. So I think Sid's a little salty because they just got beat badly, and Subban was in his ear. But I think like he's not wrong. Like that's not what was said.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, he said no. He made that up. Yeah. And I mean, yeah. That's
but you know, Sid probably was a little salty.
Yeah.
But that's kind of you know, Sid has that side to him where you can kind of feel it where he'll never be a LeBron who will just come out and complain about stuff. But you can tell when he's a little irked.
Yeah.
And I think that game irked him a bit.
Yeah. The whole thing, like, the whole exchange, and I'm including the media in this, like, you have PK Subban being facetious, not intending, his purpose when saying that was not to lie or mislead. It was just, I'm not going to say what was actually said, and you just have to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just being facetious, And then he's being facetious again. And then Crosby says, that's not what was said.
Yeah.
Because we should all know that's not what was said.
Yeah.
And it's over. It's done. Stop it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I think the media just doesn't have enough to talk about.
But Sid and PK go back because when PK was a rookie, he got in his ear. And then you had Don Cherry being like, oh, PK's got to show Sid respect.
Yeah, because everything Don Cherry says is absolutely correct.
Yeah. But so he probably has a history of being irked by PK, which all has me thinking, where would this series be without PK Subban, just like narrative-wise?
Yeah.
We'd have nothing to talk about.
Yeah.
Besides like goalies, which we just did for 40 minutes. But
goalies, and then Phil Kessel and Evgeny Malkin would probably get more play.
But I just feel like it would be so much less interesting.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's helping the entertainment value of the series for sure.
I love that he's on this stage.
I mean, having Subban on the stage, absolutely. But like, yeah, the narrative that's come out of it is...
Oh, no. The narrative sucks, but that was to be expected. Yeah. But I just mean, if he weren't here, it would just be a lot less entertaining, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, but you brought up Marty Brodeur earlier, which ties into... So, we've covered the final. Excited for Game 4.
Yes.
Tomorrow.
Yes.
We're recording on a Sunday night. Tomorrow, 6 p.m. Western. Is that what it is? Or is it 5?
5.
5. 5? 5 Pacific.
Wow. Okay.
All games are at 5. Not like the NBA Finals where they've been jumping around 6, 5, whatever.
Yeah. So, Ilya Kovalchuk.
Ooh.
Rumor to be returning to the NHL.
Yes.
Elliot Freeman reported that the three places he sees him going are naturally places where he has rapport. Marty Brodeur in St. Louis, the assistant GM. Peter DeBoer in San Jose. And Lou Lamb.
In Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
They would have to jump through some serious hoops to make the deal happen.
And it's a sign and trade, right?
Yeah. But Elliot Freeman doesn't just say stuff for nothing.
Okay. So the very first question, is there a possibility that he comes back and plays for the Devils?
I think it's zero.
Okay.
I think it's pretty... I don't think he's coming back.
In that case, this is interesting.
Yeah. I know, Mike, he is coming back to the league.
Oh, no, that's for sure.
That's a foregone conclusion. From everything that I've read, it sounds like it's almost a 0% chance he plays for the Devils. And I think there's some... Actually, I think it would hurt their cap. Like, there's some, like, cap penalty if he were to come back. Something like that. Mm-hmm. So, they have no reason to bring him back unless they're willing to live with that stuff. But given the direction of their team, I don't know if bringing back a 32-year-old guy who probably wants
34.
To win, 34-year-old guy makes a lot of sense when, you know, you have the second overall pick, second overall pick, and you're kind of in this awkward rebuild.
Yeah.
I don't know what, you know, the New Jersey Devils with Ilya Kovalchuk right now are maybe a playoff team.
I think
if everything breaks right, I think that would forward group be a lot scarier, but I still wouldn't see them in a playoff spot.
I think looking at those three teams.
So Toronto, San Jose, and
St. Louis.
St. Louis, yeah.
I'm going to start with San Jose, not because they're my team, but because I think
you can say
the only reason why Kovalchuk would sign there, why San Jose would have the ability to trade for him is if they didn't bring back Marlowe and probably Thornton.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, he made a Stanley Cup final with that coach, so there's probably...
So it'd be nice to see him on the team, but it would mean losing at least one of those guys, probably both of them. Because, you know, he's going to sign a contract, and it's not going to be an insignificant contract.
Yeah, so if you look at... If we're to draw a comparable, I think the comparable everyone's going to use is the Alexander Radulov.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's signed for 5.75, something like that. I think Kovalchuk goes for more.
I think I saw people just speculating about a potential cap hit for Kovalchuk of around like 5.5 or 6.5.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I think that sounds about right.
6.5 sounds a lot higher.
For a 34-year-old who hasn't played in the NHL for 5 years now.
Yeah.
But if the Sharks choose not to bring anyone back, their projected cap space is $14 million.
Mm-hmm.
So they could realistically sign or trade for Kovalchuk and bring back probably one of Thornton or Marlowe. Because you have to imagine Marlowe's going to get 6 at least.
Mm.
And honestly, I don't think Marlowe's going to get 6.
I think
Marlowe says he's accepted... the roles he's been playing the past couple of years. You know, at the point of his career, he knows that he's not, you know, he's not a superstar anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He's still very good because he's, you know, he's still a very, he's an excellent skater.
Mm-hmm.
So his leg is going to keep him around in the league.
Mm-hmm.
Like he said, I think he must, he can see himself easily skating for five more years without a significant drop off.
Right.
And he pushed almost 30 goals this year without even playing with Joe Thornton.
Yeah. So like, I think he gets over four.
Easily.
I think,
yeah.
You know, and this is if, I suppose wherever he signs, and probably over five, but I think six is pushing it a little bit. I don't think anyone's that delusional to give Patrick Marleau, someone who's probably best suited in a third line situation with, you know, power play time.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to give him that much money when they could, you know, go out and get someone younger and probably just as good for less. At least just as impactful.
Ooh.
Unless maybe a team that signed Martin Hansel or traded for Martin Hansel.
Well, yeah. We've talked a lot about how the Sharks have some forwards in the AHL that they could bring in for next season. I still don't know if... Well, I guess a lot of this hinges on... why am I forgetting his name right now?
Thornton?
No, the young German.
Are you talking about Timo Meier?
Timo Meier.
He's Swiss.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
He might speak German, though.
Well, he probably does.
Yeah.
He absolutely does. But for him, if he comes in, he's kind of the X factor here, because if he comes in and, let's say, is 80% of what Marleau has been, then you probably are good losing him. But I'm not convinced that the Sharks just like can't bring back Marleau, because they're already a pretty slow team.
Mm. Yeah.
He's one of their few fast wingers. You can't bring him back at his cap hit of last season at 6.6.
Yeah, no, not at all.
If you really want to, you can. I think the way you have to look at it is the Sharks still have a window to win the cup. You could overpay him just to keep the term down. So let's say you're like, okay, we'll give you close to what you were making, but we're not giving you the 3-4 years you probably want. And you probably might be able to get somewhere else, but we can offer you a better chance at winning the cup.
Yeah.
We're still probably, wherever you possibly go outside of, I mean, maybe the Rangers might make a play for him. We're probably still your best destination for winning a cup.
And it is going to be kind of interesting with Marleau, because his past two contracts, he's represented himself.
And he's probably doing pretty well then, considering the money he's gotten.
Yeah, like he wants to stay in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he knows what he wants out of a contract.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I'm not sure if he's going to do that again this time around.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if there's a possibility that he's fielding offers from other teams, then he might, you know, bring his agent in on it. But like, if he's sticking around with the Sharks, and, you know, he's willing to take at least a little bit of a pay cut, it wouldn't surprise me if he represents himself again. So, like, he seems to know what he wants and where he wants to be. So I could see him sticking around, and I hope he sticks around. But I think between Marleau and Thornton, I don't know if they can justify bringing in an Ilya Kovalchuk, who will be making, you know, probably around what they're making. And then still have, you know,
but he's also 3 years younger.
Yeah.
So he's still, you look at the way he's been playing in the KHL, you could say he's still maybe exiting his prime. Like, I think he's right in there. I mean, he's obviously not the Kovalchuk of, you know, when he was 24 and lighting the league on fire, but he's probably still a very good forward.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what we've kind of learned from Radulov and some other guys from the KHL that come over is that KHL success does seem to translate to the NHL.
Mm.
I actually saw a study today. Someone was trying to gauge how much a point in the KHL, a point in any other league is worth in the NHL.
Were they talking about who the Knights signed?
They might have been.
Yeah, they were talking about
Shipshoff.
Yeah.
But regardless, the KHL graded out the highest in terms of like predictive value.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way that if the Sharks really want to like go all in on next season, which I think they should think about, because their window is still right there, it would be difficult to bring in, difficult to impossible to bring in Kovalchuk both Marlon Thornton and address the weaknesses they have in the blue line.
Yeah.
Because to me, I don't know if they can win with the blue line they have now.
It's real questionable.
Yeah. But if you bring in Kovalchuk and you bring back both guys and you convince them both to take major pay cuts, I think what you would end up having to do is say, okay, we're going to pay you, you know, close to $3 million less than you were making, but maybe you could, you concede, all right, we'll give you like three more years of term, something.
Maybe.
You gather this like super team up front. I don't know how much closer they are to the cup with just Kovalchuk and an older Thornton. Maybe Thornton is better next season.
Maybe. I would not put it past him.
But to me, you look at the landscape of the NHL, and generally it seems that the best teams have the best blue lines.
Yeah.
And, well, outside of Pittsburgh, but they have like two Hall of Famers up front and maybe a fringe Hall of Famer in Phil Kessel.
Yeah.
But the way that blue line is set up and the teams they're going to have to beat to get to the cup final, you know, the Anaheims, the Edmontons, Nashville, all have mobile blue lines or, you know, speedy forwards. I don't know if they can hang with those guys. So maybe Kovalchuk isn't the move.
Yeah.
But you have to think, and especially for a power play that really struggled last year, to bring in a guy like Kovalchuk, that would improve their power play immensely.
I hate it when you say things that I'm about to say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was about to make the point about the power play.
Well, I mean, no, we can dive into it. I think there's...
Yeah. I mean, no, I mean, that was really all there was to it. San Jose's power play was pitiful last year, and Ilya Kovalchuk has been a great power play producer. He's very good playing up high on the power play.
Yeah.
Like, that would... I feel like that would probably help.
It would, and he's a right-hand shot.
Yeah.
So that just opens up the chessboard. I think it... And it's not just his presence alone. Like, what can Ilya Kovalchuk do for you?
Yeah.
It's just that everyone kind of gets a little bit better.
It's going to be the Kevin Durant effect, where it opens up space for other people.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting... with the other two teams.
Yeah, we should talk about those.
I'm going to hit St. Louis next. They have far less cap room, but that's because most of their players are signed through at least next year.
But they could probably screw around and trade.
Yeah, that's what
Alex Pietrangelo.
the only player they really have to re-sign this offseason is RFA Colton Parayko.
Who you have to resign.
Yeah, they have to. Yeah. He's the future of the blue
line. But he's also an RFA, and historically that usually means you get to underpay the guy and no one's going to offer sheet him. So I've stressed a lot about RFAs in the past being a Ducks writer, but I've learned that being an RFA just means the team gets a discount.
Yeah, it really does. It really does.
It's kind of a screwed up system, but that's for another podcast.
So if I can see him going to St. Louis. He'll want to play with Vladimir Tarasenko.
Yeah,
and Tarasenko will
He's got to have a Russian buddy.
Yeah. Well, and with if the two of them wind up on a line, the talent at the very least, they're going to be on the top power play.
That would be scary.
Yeah, because Tarasenko isn't just a wrist shot. Like Tarasenko is he's a multi-tool player.
Yeah.
He's a very good passer.
Yeah. He's not that fast though.
No, he's not.
And I think Kovalchuk could help because Kovalchuk isn't necessarily the fastest. But he attacks in a straight line more, whereas Tarasenko likes to kind of weave.
Yeah, he does.
And he's good at it. He's probably, I don't know, one of the 10 best wingers in the league. Probably easily, yeah.
Yeah.
But with Kovalchuk, you kind of get... I mean, for any team, they'd pick him up. But maybe especially for the Blues, who aren't really the most fun to watch offensively or the most dynamic, he gives them something that they severely lack, which is just like... A guy who's going to crash the net, not really care about what other people think doing it, and who's going to have that booming one-timer. They don't really have a guy because, I mean, maybe I don't watch enough of the Blues maybe, but I don't think Tarasenko is much of a one-timer.
No, he does, but it's his wrist shot. His wrist shot is his
He likes
brother.
To curl off the half wall and, lodge it top shelf, which he's good at.
He takes the wrist shot. Like he's sort of like Brent Burns where he really likes going through legs or just using the players in front of him as a screen and then firing off a wicked accurate wrist shot. Most of his goals, you see him do that.
And he's only 25.
Yeah.
I forgot how young he was.
Yeah.
He's signed through 2023 at 7.5. I feel that's going to be a good deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's probably due for like three more prime years, maybe. But anyway. I think it seems like St. Louis would have to do some pretty heavy juggling.
Yeah, they would have to trade, but I could see, you know, Kolchuk, like, bringing in Kolchuk and whoever they'd have to let go. You know, because St. Louis, you know, their bottom guys aren't really...
Yeah.
They're not required.
The Neil Yakupov experiment didn't really work out. Magnus Pjärvi, I don't know... Honestly, I haven't paid much attention to him, but I also haven't heard his name in a while.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
They're both RFAs. I think you can thank them for their services. And
Yakupov is probably going... If he's playing hockey next year, he's probably going to be back in Russia.
Possibly.
I don't know if anyone...
No, he wants to be here.
But,
he
you know, really the fact that...
I don't think anyone wants him here.
The fact that they're both restricted and that they haven't really... I mean, because Pjärvi was I think he was a lottery pick.
Mm.
The fact that they're RFAs, they could probably bring them back for cheap.
Yeah.
And be fine, because they're going to need some sort of depth, even if they bring in Kolchuk. But they would have to move... I think the guy I'm looking at is probably Jay Bomeister. They would probably have to move off of him, because he's 33. He's making 5.4 for the next two seasons.
And New Jersey can use defense.
Yeah, but they would never take him.
No, they wouldn't. But
I don't know which team would take Jay Bomeister at this point, actually.
You throw him back to Calgary. Actually, their defense doesn't need him at all. Never mind.
I just... That's an ugly contract.
Yeah.
Shoot.
And I've never obviously been in this position, so I don't know for sure, but just from an outside perspective, am I the only one that thinks that, there's the Kovalchuk-DeBoer connection or stuff like that? Am I the only one that thinks that's kind of overrated when it comes to players deciding where they want to go?
And sometimes...
I'd have to, like, go back and check, because I think, from what I've seen, I think with Russian players, it matters a little bit more in terms of not just, like, are there other Russians on the team? But generally, those are the kind of guys who tend to clash with management and coaching. So if they have a pre-established comfort level, I think that probably matters a little bit more for those guys than, say, you know, your run-of-the-mill Canadian winger.
Maybe. Right?
But, yeah, but I don't know.
I just think that if he's coming back, then his motivation, it can't be money, because he already said no to a whole bunch of money, you know, when he got that massive contract. So it's got to be the cup, right? I would think he's trying to come back to wherever he can win the cup.
Yeah. So we'll see. I think St. Louis would be interesting.
Yeah. And like you said, they would definitely have to do some juggling.
They'd have to do some juggling. I think it'd be worth it, though, for them.
For them, yeah, absolutely.
Because with the way they're kind of positioned, you know, Tarasenko, yeah, he's 25, but at the same time, as we've seen with teams like, you know, Montreal, where they had Pacioretty on that really good deal, all of a sudden they get to their later 20s and they're not cheap anymore, and then, you know, you've wasted a few years.
Yeah.
Tarasenko is locked up, but still, he's on a good value contract. You want to take advantage of that. Also, Robbie Fabry is still on his ELC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you want to take advantage of that. And then I'm assuming Parayko's not going to be making that much, even on his next deal. So now, like, for them, now is kind of the time to strike.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, you put him on that team, and we saw what they did in the playoffs. And, I mean, they...
And adding Vladimir Sobotka.
Yeah. I think, they'd be interesting. So the third team, Toronto. Oh, this is a fun one. Let me pull up Toronto's cap sheet. This is a fun one.
Yeah.
This is going to be a borderline stupid question.
Okay.
So, you know, Toronto has a bunch of young talent, you know, and not just coming up. They were here last year.
Yeah, like they're already good.
Yeah. and so my question, you know, do they have room for Ilya Kovalchuk? And, you know, this is a stupid question, because does an NHL team have room for Ilya Kovalchuk?
Well, their projected cap space for next season is $12 million. They have Matt Hunwick, Roman Polak coming off the books. I think you can probably replace them with, you know, Johnny AHLer.
And the guy they sort of lost was Brian Boyle. And, you know,
I don't think they ever plan on bringing him back.
No.
Well, yeah. And then you have Connor Brown and Zach Hyman, who are RFAs. There's a lot of Connor Brown hype, which I think he's a good player, but I don't think they're going to be paying him all that much. And, I mean, the whole thesis around Toronto right now is you want to be really good when your best players aren't costing you anything. Matthews, Nylander, Marner, they're on their ELCs for, well, Nylander only has one more year of ELC, and then he's an RFA, while the two other guys have two more years.
Yeah.
So for Toronto, I look at the way they pushed Washington in round one, and it didn't feel like they were necessarily going to win that series, but it felt like they weren't too far off either.
Right. Totally.
You add in an Ilya Kovalchuk, and you still have cap room to do other things. Kevin Shattenkirk.
I think that's a good idea.
Look, yeah, it's a very good idea, actually. If they bring in Kovalchuk and they add, you know, let's say a decent to above average blue liner, I mean, you're looking at a really good team in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you have to also account for the fact that their top talent is going to be better next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing with adding Kovalchuk is...
it's frightening.
Oh, man. This is kind of frightening.
That was a fuck all the way from Montreal.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Missed windows.
The thing about adding Kovalchuk is, you know, now there is going to be a very good winger playing on the third line. And, you know, we've seen recently, a third line being, you know, required, not just, you know, throw them out there as an energy line.
It's a required course.
But, you know, it's sort of a, you know, it's your third skill line. That sounds very dumb. Well, that sounds very dumb.
It's a top nine now.
Yeah.
You have your top nine, and then you have your kind of like penalty killing line, or your win face-offs and punch someone in the mouth line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think Toronto might be the most likely because they had the less to do.
It just feels like with them... to do. Well, keep in mind, though, that this would be a sign and trade.
Yeah.
So something's going back the other way. With a guy who you know would never sign on that team, I don't know how much leverage the Devils would have. I don't know what they could possibly get for him.
Draft pick. Like, they could probably get a second round, maybe a first round, because, I mean...
You know, yeah, that'd be interesting.
Like you said, their young guys are here. You know? Yeah. So, like, they can, you know, avoid... Or they can... absorb having one of their good, like, high draft picks for a player that would be around for a couple years in his prime.
Yeah, because they have their core.
Yeah.
I don't think they need to go. And I don't even know what draft pick they have this year, but it's not anything wild. And as far as, you know, if I'm New Jersey, here's what's interesting. If I'm New Jersey and I want a first-round draft pick in return, let's say I want a first and a second.
That'd be a lot, but okay.
Well, it might not be a lot, but it also permits either, let's say, a first-round draft pick or, like, bad contract you want to get rid of plus, like, prospect. Something like that.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Because I'm helping you out, and you're helping me out a little bit.
Yeah.
What's interesting is if you're sending someone a draft pick, you kind of want them to not be good.
Right.
So which team is going to be the worst out of those three? Which team would give you the best draft position? And I don't think it would be Toronto. I think if you send a first rounder to Toronto, you're getting the 27th pick next season or something.
Yeah.
But by the same token, their pick, I'm assuming, is going to be pretty high.
And also, Toronto and New Jersey are in the same conference, so they stand to possibly hurt each other a little more.
Yeah. Yeah. Because then those games against Toronto are a must win to help their draft position.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm kind of looking at the Sharks there.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be a lot of fun. I just can't wait to see how good he is still. I'm sure. Yeah,
he's still point per game player.
816 points in 816 games.
And that's why I think the relative unknown factor, because we know how good he was 5 years ago. Now, I think that's what really kills their leverage more than anything, is that we know how good this guy was. We know how good he was in the KHL, but how does that really translate?
Yeah.
So maybe the package I've brought up might be a little steep, but I think something around there. You're not going to see nothing significant, but it's going to be all these little pieces that are going to help the Devils.
Yeah.
But it all kind of depends what the Devils want, because they're a head scratcher right now in terms of the direction of their team. I kind of lump them in with like the Flyers, where it's like they're not really good enough to win anything in their conference, but they're not bad enough to bottom out.
Yeah. And so, you know, when they got Corey Schneider, you know, they were, you know, replacing Marty, and you know, it's like, okay, we got our guy, we got a really good goalie, and he is a very good goalie.
Potentially replaced him 2 years too late, but
but you know, now it's not really panning out like how Brodeur could, you know, sort of will them to a Stanley Cup. And Schneider's, like I said, very, very good, but it's that it doesn't seem like they're not having a typical New Jersey type, I don't know, synergy between You know, the goalie and the way they play.
Well, that blue line's just been so brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, so.
I can barely name the blue line.
Green yeah. and.
Severson.
Severson, yeah.
Yeah, he's still there.
John Merrill?
Yeah. Yeah. This is just, this is not, this great content.
But, I mean, their forward group has things to like. I mean, I think.
Taylor Hall.
Palmieri was a really nice find for them.
Yeah.
If Camilleri can ever just be healthy.
And you can say the same thing about Bo Bennett.
Mm-hmm. So they, and you know, they're going to get either Nolan Patrick or Nico Hischier.
Mm-hmm.
So New Jersey's in a weird spot. What would you do if you're in New Jersey? And then we'll wrap up.
In general or just like, regarding Kovalchuk? Or?
Well, you kind of know what you're going to do with Kovalchuk. You're going to trade him. Yeah. But I mean, you know, the direction of the franchise philosophically.
I'm always reluctant to blow teams up
yeah.
because when you have
a soft blow up,
when you have Corey Schneider and like the prime of Taylor Hall, you want to find a way to make that work.
I agree with that.
But
yeah,
but they do need to build up that blue line. I don't know if I wouldn't want to give up on, you know, the Taylor Hall era yet. So I would try and fill in some pieces and see what I could do.
I mean, what they could do, like, they need to address defense, as we said. And what they could do is, you know, trade for, you know, prospects, you know, and like you said, have a little give and take.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe they could go in and, you know, make a play for Shattenkirk.
Yeah, because, I mean,
they have a lot of cap room. Right now, it's at $21 million.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Who do they have to bring back?
Bo Bennett.
Severson's an RFA. Well, Stephen Nason, whatever. Okay, wow. Their cap sheet is really nice, actually.
And they have a lot of draft picks.
I see you at New Jersey front office.
Yeah, they have a lot of draft picks the next 3 years.
Here's my thing. I actually really agree with Nick in the sense that if they bought him out, the guys they're going to be bottoming him out to get are going to be guys like... they're going to be bottoming out for a Taylor Hall.
Yeah,
yeah.
Essentially, you have him. You're going to have a Nico Hischier or a Nolan Patrick who are at least going to be, you know, first-line guys for the foreseeable future on entry-level contracts. I don't think anyone's saying they're going to be Austin Matthews-like impact in their first year. But then again, last year, no one knew how to project Austin Matthews either. So maybe because we've seen these guys so much in the CHL that we have underrated them a little bit. But at the very least, they're going to be good NHL players. And then you have Pavel Zacha, who is only 20, who's also on an ELC, who I think is going to be pretty good as soon as maybe next year. You kind of have this window to, you know, take a real shot at it. I didn't realize Corey Schneider's 31, though. That's troublesome.
That sounds about right.
But he's as good of a goaltender, I think, as you're going to get on the free agent market.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like you're going to be bottoming out for the guys you kind of already have.
Yeah.
So why not do something?
Yeah. Over the next...
Why not bring back Kovalchuk?
Over the next 2 years, have a possible... They would have 14 draft picks, just, you know, without any other wheeling and dealing. Right now, they have 20 draft picks over the next 2 years.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. That's a lot.
And a lot of that is in the first three rounds. Wait,
one of those is bound to hit.
Yeah. So, like, in Trey Kovalchuk, they're at least going to get one more draft pick, whether it's going to be a first, second, or third rounder. Yeah. Thinking it's probably at least going to be a second rounder.
Yeah. They're actually pretty nicely positioned.
Yeah.
I didn't really realize.
Yeah, they're in their, like, they've built up, you know, their base to start the rebuild, and they're ready to make their moves.
And what's nice about their cap sheet, which I'm looking at right now, and it's really nice. I mean, they're not tied up to anyone long term besides the guys that, you know, like they have Taylor Hall at $6 million, which it continues to be a steal given the fact he's only 25 and that he's been incredibly productive. Mike Camilleri, you only have him for 2 more years at $5 million, which isn't a backbreaker.
Hell, they have enough cap room to take either Pronger or Dotsuk's contract.
Well, I think Pronger's
it's their turn, isn't it?
Pronger's officially retired now.
Oh, is he? Is his contract ended?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
it's off the books now. And then they've locked up Palmieri for the next 4 seasons. He's only 26. So, but outside of that, they don't really have any bad money. I think the only contract you kind of worried a little bit about might be Corey Schneider. He signed through 2022. He's already 31, so that's the next 5 years.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that looks, but you can at least probably reasonably expect for him to be pretty good for the next 2 years still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're in an interesting spot.
Yeah.
Huh.
So
interesting.
So we're saying they're coming back. They're on the way back.
Well, the thing with the Devils is they have the skeleton of a good team. They are still a long way from being contenders, but they're going to have the flexibility. I mean, hell, like half their blue line comes off the books after next season. Merrill's an RFA, but still, like, it's going
to
be interesting.
Yeah, they've got stuff to work with.
Well, anyway, we're talking New Jersey Devils cap sheet, so
in the middle of the Stanley Cup final.
That might be a sign that we should probably wrap things up. Although I think we should do like off-season previews for each team. That's something we'll talk about.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I'm down.
All right. Well, hey, guys, thank you for listening to the Garage Hockey Podcast. If you've been enjoying the show, make sure to leave a review on iTunes. Helps the show get noticed. And if anything, we just love to hear from you guys. Love to hear your comments. Follow us on Twitter at Garage Hockey Pod, Facebook.com/GarageHockeyPod. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll catch you the next pod.